Welcome to episode 53 of the Nerd Extravaganza podcast, where the hosts are men of more letters than are contained in the human genome. I'm Tom.
I'm Rick.
I'm Brian.
And tonight we will be joined by special guest and real man of letters, Chuck Wendig. But before Chuck takes the stage, let's take a walk back in time with our usual geekly, weekly, weekly geekly roundup.
I spent all week doing basically two things. I obsessed over my upcoming Star Wars Edge of the Empire character, and when I got like a headache from doing that, I would play, what's this game called? Jones on Fire on my Android.
Jones on Fire? Was that an Indiana Jones game?
No, it's about a female fire person, fire woman, whatever, rescuing kitties from a fire.
Grace Jones.
Joan of Arc. Joan of Arcadia.
Joan Can't Rivers. If you fail, the kitties drag her to safety, so not Joan of Arc.
Robot Jones.
Joan of Arcadia.
Meow.
Cool, man.
My character is going to be awesome if I can ever choose which awesome to go with.
Oh, I'm glad you're spending a lot of time in character development, sir.
Yeah, you never would have expected that from me, obsessing mindlessly over the tiniest detail.
Well, as I remember, you're the person who spends like infinite amounts of time, yeah, customizing video game characters, like just their appearance, before you even get into stats.
Yeah.
Is that called min-maxing? Is that what that's called?
Well, min-maxing's for less character concept and more like stats that are badass, so you win the game.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm not doing that. Like, I'm trying to, you know, be like a fun like idea to play and
credit
not...
to you.
I'm an orphan.
That would get
I'm
you
a Rodian lesbian.
Thespian. Thespian. Credit goes to the Lair Dwellers podcast, of which I'm a fan, for planting min-maxing in my head this week. Just throwing that out. Anything else, Brian?
That's it, man. I'm not serious. I obsessed and then relaxed rescuing cats and then obsessed some more. And...
Wow. That's a well-spent week by any measure. What about you, Ricky?
Well, last week's episode got me all hot and bothered over my MakerBot again, so I spent some more time living in the future, printing on my 3D printer. And when I wasn't 3D printing in the beautiful, wonderful future, I was playing Terraria. I'm addicted.
Awesome.
And then what else did I do? Oh, I spent a lot of time kind of computer nerding out a little bit. I got a new graphics tablet for my computer. I got a Wacom Cintiq 13 HD. For those who aren't familiar with that, it's your basic standard graphics tablet that you use a pen to draw, you know, in illustration programs or whatever, and it shows up on the computer. But the cool thing about this one is, rather than just being a tablet, it's also a monitor, so you draw right onto the monitor. It's pretty sweet. So I've been getting that all set up and fine-tuned, working on some artwork, some 3D MakerBots, and a lot of planting in Terraria. Digging and planting, baby.
Cool, man. I'm glad that we rekindled interest in your MakerBot. It's what we aim to do here on the show. Rekindle people's interest in things that they should never lose interest in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah. For my part, I have been, of course, playing Ni No Kuni, as usual, and preparing in my nerdy way to basically switch my location to Seattle, which is my home away from home. Most people would be worrying about what clothes to pack and that sort of thing, but that's a secondary concern. I'm trying to get as much like tinkering stuff as far as Arduino and such packed as possible, and clothes are getting like second billing in terms of importance. I was inspired by our Nerdy Needs episode to set about a little project once I get out there, so hopefully I'll be updating you guys from afar on my progress, maybe via some YouTube videos.
Nice.
Yeah, so some Ni No Kuni, some nerdy packing, and some reading. I finally started reading again. I started reading a book I referenced many shows ago all about virtual reality and virtual worlds, and I will be sure to link that up again in the show notes.
What's it called?
It's called... I can't remember the name of it because I couldn't remember the name of it last time we talked about it either, but I'm reading it. It's the one about virtual worlds and infinite reality. That's what it's called. Infinite reality, and I don't remember the subtitle.
I just finished reading another book as well. This is probably the third book since the last time I talked about books on here. I finished Lights, which was a Disney book about the Main Street Electrical Parade. I finished Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. And I finished It's Kind of a Cute Story, which is kind of a biography kind of book, life story kind of thing about Rolly Crump, who was a pretty badass Imagineer. So I'm looking for a new book, so that's why I was asking you about the title.
I recommend that one. It'll definitely be in the show notes, and I'll definitely share it with you. It's good. If you want to just see where people are who research in the field of virtual reality think things are going, it's made for an interesting read so far.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's it. That's it for my roundup. Doing some reading, doing some game playing, and getting ready for a trip. And hoping when I get to my destination, I can do some making. But what I hope we have is the makings of a good show with tonight's special guest, the one, the only, Chuck Wendig. Welcome, sir.
Well, thanks, guys. How are you?
Doing well. Doing well. You were introduced to our little group by way of friend of the podcast, April, and Brian, whom you have met in person.
I have. I have indeed. Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, good. Good. That makes one of us.
Well, good.
It's just drudgery for us at this point.
This is horrible. This is horror and sadness.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah. Grief-struck podcast.
It's the worst. It's a fate worse than... I don't know what's worse. So you guys met... you were doing a reading, if I'm not mistaken, at a local venue here in Fort Lauderdale. Is that correct?
That is true. I was at the Stranahan House, the lovely Stranahan House, doing a reading for one of my new novels coming out, The Blue Blazes.
We'll get into background and stuff later, but I guess we can kick things off right up front. Can you give us a synopsis on that one?
Yeah, The Blue Blazes. There's a character, Mookie Pearl, and he stands at the crux of the criminal underworld, smashing into the sort of traditional death, mythic, monstrous underworld. The criminal enterprises is being infringed upon by the monsters of the down below, and he's this... you know, meaty, thick-necked, charcuterie-loving thug who stands in the way of all the horrors. So it's like urban fantasy, sort of horror-y, noir-y, you know, all that good stuff.
Cool. Kind of genre blending, I guess?
Yeah. I like to bend all the genres because, you know, that's sort of what people grew up... Like, I grew up on reading everything, right? So it's like I just sort of like to shove it all in each book. Every book is a twister.
Cool. Please feel free to plug that in all your works at any time.
All right. Hold on. You have I have 15 minutes. Can you guys just be quiet for a minute?
Yeah, actually, we were just going to sign off and give you the floor, and we'll check in the morning.
Sweet. Cool. I'm just going to read out Amazon links, which will take a while.
Yeah.
A lot of digits and letters.
Do you remember when you used to listen? Well, maybe you won't admit to listening to NPR, but I did. And,
oh, no, I still do, sadly.
Okay.
Yeah.
This was in my youth, sadly, but they used to read out, you can check out this internet website at http
www. Yeah. You're like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah. When the web was new and misunderstood.
Right. You basically fall asleep in your car and crash into a telephone pole, and they're still reading it. And you're like, oh,
that's good. Slash.
No. Slash colon ampersand.
I know. Slash ARPY749. Like, oh, God damn. Thank you, NPR.
So that said, I guess we should get into some Q&A, which is sort of the purpose of tonight's episode.
All the Q's, which sounds really pornographic now that I say it that way.
Is that a title of a porn? It should be.
It should be. All the Q's.
What will be the name of the stars? We'll think that over throughout the course of
the episode. You've got a whole new podcast name right there.
We A every Q.
That's right.
Every which way.
Wink, wink.
All right. I guess we'll start with basics. We have a very blunt show outline item here that I think fits. I think you'll be able to handle it. Right. We'll start with, who are you?
Oh, man, that's what an existential question. Who are we, really? Who are all of us? No, I'm a writer as obviously I plucked a book, so people probably already figured that shit out. I've been writing, you know, on and off for professionally for the last 16 years. I worked in games. I've worked in a little film and television. I have, I think at this point, coming up about 14 or 15 novels in the last couple of years that'll be published from various publishers, including AgriRobot and Abaddon and Amazon Children's. I've got a website where I spout sort of dubious nonsense about writing advice and life advice and things toddlers do, because I have a toddler and he is insane and it's funny. So that's sort of where I'm at. That's me in the professional sense. Unless you want to know personal stuff like my sign and my loves and interests, we could talk about that too.
We usually, most of our guests, we do put up a personals profile on our page.
Nice, good. Match.com or something. Or, some
yeah, Christian. With geolocation stuff so stalkers can find you more easily.
That's good.
That's a service we provide. Yeah.
We also stream over to nerdlove.org. So.
Oh, that's good. Hot librarian girls with glasses.
Always.
But yeah, nick. Yeah, if go with lucky. That.
Yeah,
that's who they are. That.
I mean, I dress up as a hot librarian girl with glasses. That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that who doesn't really once in a while.
We're all on the same boat here.
We're on odd days. So, did you start in gaming, or how did you get into gaming initially?
Yeah, I started with. I mean, for a long time, obviously, as a kid, I played a lot of D&D and White Wolf games, Vampire and Werewolf, and all that stuff. And I said, well, yeah, no, that'd be cool to write that stuff. And I wanted to write novels eventually. But I thought, well, it'd be good to figure out actually how to write first by writing professionally in a, forgive the term, sort of a lesser industry. And I don't mean like gaming is a lesser industry because it's one of my favorite places, but it's not big, quote unquote, big publishing.
Mm.
So there was online a request by White Wolf Game Studios at the time to write for their game at the time, Hunter the Reckoning, and it said, like, well, write us 1,000 words for what you think this game means. And I wrote this wildly pretentious essay about, like, internal and external loci of fear. And it was wow. Completely off the charts, nonsense academic. And they totally bought my horseshit and hired me to write for them. For that, for one book, and then someone dropped off another book, and they hired me on for that one. And then next thing I knew, it sort of snowballed into what actually became kind of a full-time freelance job for a while. So I've written, I think, over 2 million words for the game industry. And I did some video game work in there, too. So it was like kind of a whole big thing. A lot of games.
So it sounds like you elevated the art with your... You call it pretentious, but it sounds like it was... like somebody from the realm of the proper written word coming down and civilizing these.
Well, I figured it was like, well, that's kind of White Wolf's shtick in a way, is that they really like that sort of sense of elevating and escalating just straight up horror to being something a little more intellectual at times, which is fun for me. You know, it's something to do as a writer. It's not just like, you know, goblin attack. It's like, all right, well, let's talk about the existential dread of the goblin. That'll be more fun.
Goblin attack is like my that's my go-to. That's every bad DM's go-to encounter. Then goblins came.
I'm going to take a nap, fight the goblins.
You do all the rolling. I don't like this part.
I hate you.
So, with your millions of words written, mm-hmm. you that led to the writing of what we call books, I guess?
Books. Yes, I believe they're called novels or novels. I'm not really, it might be a B. I'm not really sure what that. I did the game writing thing for a long time, and I did some game development for a while. And then I had been writing novels that whole time and failing at writing anything worth anything. It was mostly either unfinished stuff or novels that were just basically buckets of like chum. So there came a point when I had a pretty good idea for a novel, and I spent many years trying to actually write it successfully, and I totally failed. And then I sort of cheated because there was this local screenwriting competition, and the prize of the screenwriting competition was a mentorship with a year with a prominent screenwriter. In this case, it's a screenwriter named Steven Susko, who did both Grudge films and Jack Ketchum's Red adaptation. And somehow I won, and I was sort of going to cheat. I was like, well, I don't really want to write screenplays, so what I want to do is use his knowledge of story and figure out how to fix and finish my book. which actually worked. He helped me sort of workshop that, and I did write the book before I wrote it as a finished novel. I actually wrote it as a finished screenplay, and then ended up turning it into this book, which then got an agent and then got published, and then that was the whole... That began everything. It began my ascent to fame and fortune, because writing is full of fame and fortune.
So we've heard.
Mm-hmm. True story. Rolling around in cash and supermodels.
Oh, yeah, rolling around in supermodels is always fun. With cash, even better.
Supermodel librarians. I help sometimes and they scream, but I mean, whatever.
So, to be clear, you cheated by producing quality work. So that you could eventually
not quality work that I was supposed to be producing. It was like, I want to write a novel, so I'm going to cheat this contest and win a screenwriting mentorship for a year, which is a weird prize, by the way, because it's basically like you win homework. So it's like, you know, it's like now you have to work. It's like, oh shit, like I wanted a pony or something, but instead I get a screenwriting. So no, it actually turned out pretty cool. And then I ended up where Steven, the mentor, actually hooked me up with a writing partner who was also local and who makes films. And from there we wrote a film together that took us to the Sundance Screenwriting Lab. And we had a short film made, and we did some transmedia. We actually continue to do transmedia work, and we did this digital narrative called Collapsus out of the Netherlands. And that was nominated for an International Digital Emmy, which is actually an Emmy Award, but it sounds like it's not because you put international and digital.
Yeah.
It sounds like some weak sauce, like tiny, like, you know, like an egg. Like they just punch you in the face with this Emmy.
Sounds like cheating.
It sounds like it's cheating. It's all cheating. Writing is always cheating.
Again, though, I want to go over that. There are people who strive to put out quality work in the fields of screenwriting and I'm sure game writing as well.
Yeah.
And who fall short of the mark. You did those on the way to your destination.
Yes. So, they were accidental to some point.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for you.
I guess. Thanks.
Yeah. Successful work accidentally produced. That's great.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Yeah, I guess it's better than crap work purposely produced. Well, that was my first 10 years of writing was a whole lot of bad stuff. So,
well, now it's interesting to talk about that and then to talk about sort of the cheating. The prize you won, you called it homework, but in a way it was maybe focus or motivation or something that brought about focus.
Yeah, it was what brought about focus. And the way I got focus was I talked about this actually a lot today on Twitter for whoever cares to follow me there. I learned how to outline. That was the thing that I was missing. Not every writer needs to or should outline, but I obviously really need to. There's that so-called thing where the pantser, like the writer who pantses, like he writes without, sounds like he writes without pants on, but it's like, you know, by the seat of my pants. And they don't plot, they don't plan. And I was one of those because I was like, I would never outline. You will ruin my art. My magic will be destroyed if I outline. And I resisted it for a long time, even in that mentorship. And he said, we have to outline this. And I said, I really don't want to. He says, no, really, you have to outline this. And I was like, fuck you, I'm an artist. And finally I did it. And then it turns out, like, that's all it really took. I was like, oh, now I actually have a story. There's a story here. Look at that.
Prior to accepting the yoke of the outliner, were you finding, like, you would have all these brilliant bits and just sort of floating out there and weren't able to sort of connect them?
Yeah, basically. I was like an old person lost in the mall. It was just like, I was seeing cool stuff, but like I couldn't figure out where I was. And I was like, oh, that's bangles. I like bangles. That's like, oh, CDs. I listen to CDs. And I just would wander around for a while without any sort of sense of how to get out of the mall.
These gyros smell like my pants. Like, yeah, just completely right.
That's a true story.
All right, I have a real quick question before we move on. Was your so-called shit work, was that critically acclaimed shit work, or was it or was it like just your decision that it was shit work, so you never really presented it to the masses?
Well, like the novels that I think I wrote 6 complete novels before ever actually having one that did anything. Those were not critically acclaimed, nor were they published. They may have been critically acclaimed by my garbage man. Otherwise, no. My game work was less shit work because it was edited. I had editors who kind of punched me into submission, taught me how to do things a little better and work on a deadline and put words together into sentences. And that was also not critically acclaimed, although later in the game stuff I did win like, I think an Annie Award or something for something I worked on.
So it was all self-proclaimed garbage. It wasn't
self-proclaimed shit work. Yeah.
I guess, would it be fair to say that if there was somebody out there, an aspiring writer, say, who actually may have raw talent but isn't able to focus it, is it fair to say that your advice would be to find someone to yell at you and to keep you moving?
I would be that person to yell at them. For instance, I hate the word aspiring in front of a writer. I'm not like you, Dick, but I mean like people who call themselves out, like, I'm an aspiring writer. It's like, well, fucking write or don't. I mean, you either put your fingers on keyboard and make words happen and then you write, or you pretend and you're one of those people who tells me about the book that they have living in them like some gestational alien. Spring out, like, oh, now I'm a bestseller. Fucking la-di-da, that's great. That never happens, and it's like, stop aspiring. Shit or get off the pot, man.
Good point. I mean, I've been an aspiring Mr. Universe my whole life.
Me too.
And it's just not coming together for me.
Yeah.
With the occasional gym.
I'm not even going to competitions. Like, I'm not even there. I feel like that's, I'm just aspiring.
Yeah. I don't even want to take my shirt off yet. You know, that's how aspiring I am. Yeah, I guess anybody can aspire without doing a damned thing. So I'm
ways, like, people who are generally aspiring authors, they want to sort of sound like they're authors, like they're artsy and important, and it's like, they love the idea of writing, of being a writer. Like, I'm sipping Hemingway daiquiris and and I'm troubled at Starbucks again. But it's like, you're just looking at Twitter on your iPad. That's what you're doing.
You've got the right sweater and the right air of superiority about you, but you've got nothing backing it up, man.
Right. You've got that author photo with your fist under your chin and you're staring seriously at the black and white photo. But otherwise, you haven't actually written anything.
Write something in that brand new 3-pack of moleskins, buddy.
Exactly. Unwrap them. Put your pen in there. Not your penis, your pen.
Your pen.
Write something.
But the penis thing might be sort of the angle for some of these folks. They might just be like aspiring, what do you call someone who gets laid? A layant?
Yes, a lay person.
Yeah, there you go. They're aspiring lay people. So they're posing. Well, I mean, you did mention Offspring, so it worked for you to write.
Yeah, apparently it does. Yeah.
Good. So they're onto something.
I have a writer musk, an authorial scent I give off. But it can't be aspiring. You actually have to do it. And it's the only way you give off the pheromones is to actually do it.
Right. You might get maybe one coupling with just the aspirant pheromone. But the real author gives off an unmistakable musk. Yeah.
Yeah. It turns from desperation to strength and victory.
Nothing turns a girl on like a cramped wrist. I don't know.
Exactly. Like a lack of health care.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You're not... You're not doing much to reinforce my illusion that authors are like rich and live in like cool, like Stephen King style, like compounds.
No, we are not rich. I mean, to be frank, actually, I do fairly well in terms of making a living, and I do it full time, and I largely support the house I live in. That being said, I have to write a whole lot to do that. I'm not like I get to write my one book every 3 years and roll around on all the royalties. Like, I mean, I've literally, by the end of this month, I will have written 3 complete novels this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're only like halfway through the year, so if my math's right.
Right. So it's like I've got to bust my ass to sort of keep that up.
Wow.
Yeah.
That brings us to the next question, actually, since you mentioned the 3 novels. Nice. So you mentioned the one work at the beginning. What are you working on in total right now?
I just finished... I have a young adult series coming out starting in July. It's called the Heartland Trilogy. It's this, I call it corn punk, which started as a joke, but it's like it turned into a real book. And it's this young adult series about the sort of a agricultural dystopia where the corn has basically taken over. And so the first book is called Under the Empyrean Sky, and then the second book is called Blightborn. And so I just finished that, and it's the longest book I've ever done. It was 120,000 words. And so then I just literally immediately segued into the third book in my Miriam Black series, which is about a girl who can see how you're going to die by touching you. And she's a twisted, sort of profane, very angry person. And I was just down in Florida actually doing research for this book. It's called The Cormorant. And so that's what I'm working on right now. I'm kind of punching my way through that book. Very angry, profane, whiskey and cigarettes kind of book. It's a lot of fun.
So Florida made a perfect setting, I guess.
Yeah, Florida's, you know, you got, it's a little trashy down there, and I mean that in a good way.
Like,
you know.
Yeah. We're like a trashy California, I guess.
Yeah. Like sticky, one of the trashy books is written like in Pennsylvania here, but in the part of Pennsylvania that I consider Pennsylvania. It's like sort of like, you know, just on the edge of like meth town. Like it's just kind of right there. So books like that make for good fiction.
I should disclose now that I have kinfolk in Kentucky.
See? There you go.
Yeah. I don't care. You're saying nothing that that I could rightfully take offense to.
It's all good. It's like I said, Pennsylvania's, man, it's not always, you know, top shelf stuff.
I didn't meet anyone from Pennsylvania until I joined the military, and the impression I came away with, having met many Pennsylvanianites or whatever they're called,
right,
is that it's kind of like the south of the north.
Parts of it are. Well, that's the joke, is they say, you know, Pennsylvania is basically Pittsburgh on one end, Philadelphia on the other, and Kentucky in the middle.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So something near and dear to my heart and that has increased my reading, and I think Rick's as well, is the electronic reader, the e-reader, or the tablet, or basically the digital means of reading what would otherwise be on paper.
Right.
What do you have an opinion regarding that sort of delivery method?
It is good. I am a fan. It's great because, first of all, on a very simple level, it means I can walk on a plane and carry what is essentially my entire library without shattering my spine into tiny little pieces. The other level, as the author side of things, I can publish my own work. Self-publishing used to, and still to some degree, has a sort of a stink on it. And notably so, because it means anybody can publish anything they want. Like, I wrote a book about my dog. And you're like, okay, well, I mean, that's great. That's super good. Or like, I wrote erotica. And you're like, that's going to be really not attractive. But it's fine. But the good thing is, you know, obviously, there's an easy way that you can go right to Amazon, right to Barnes & Noble, and I can put out, and I do put out some self-published work in addition to my quote-unquote traditionally published work. And it, you know, it's a 70% royalty, while there's obviously no advance. I mean, it tends to make a pretty good amount of money. So it's a good way for an author to take a little more control of his destiny in terms of writing. So the e-reader thing is super hot. I'm a big fan of it. Obviously, I like paper books sometimes. I'm not one of those book sniffers, but for some books I really love or by authors I really dig, I will tend to buy the big print versions. But e-readers, man, it's like super awesome. I don't like that some e-books are more expensive than the print books. Yeah. I know there's the occasional publisher who'll be like, well, but really there's a reason for that. And it's like, no, there's not. I know. Stop lying. That's just a bullshit thing you say because they don't want to destroy their distribution chain.
So that's interesting. I guess that's the next question I was going to ask. You don't see traditional publishing and the traditional means through which, you know, materials put out there, you don't see that going away. You see that existing in parallel with the sort of...
Yeah, I mean, it's been a little weaker, but obviously traditional publishing is also still doing and is succeeding very well at creating digital reading technology. I mean, they put out ebooks. So, I don't think that's going away anytime soon. I think it'll change, and I think smaller publishers will rise to fill the gaps when the big Godzillas fall, which may happen. At least one or two of them will, or they'll do like they're doing now, which is merging, like Random House and Penguin formed Random Penguin or whatever the hell they're going to be. So that's going to be a thing that happens, and we're all going to have to deal with in the future.
Is that is it too early to tell if that's just a rearranging of the deck chairs, or?
Yeah, it's probably too early to tell.
Yeah.
You know, it's not good because it reduces competition and people will be laid off and authors will lose contracts. But hey, whatever. They do what they got to do. I don't have any contracts with them, so ha, screw it.
Well, that would, so the authors would be out what advances in that case? I don't know how the business works, but.
Well, it depends. Generally speaking, the publishing industry is far more forgiving than the music industry. If you get an advance and they cancel your book, you probably keep your advance.
Oh, okay.
So if it was in a good advance, which may be all the money you would have ever made on that book anyway, hey, great. And then you actually would be able to theoretically be able to theoretically, I say, depending on the contract, be able to try to resell that book somewhere. So financially, it's not always terrible, but it means your book's not getting on a shelf, which is... And publishing can be slow. I mean, it's like, you know, by the time you get accepted to get published, it's like a year and a half before you're even on a shelf.
Mm. So, given that writing both self and traditionally published works is now your full-time job, and given the fact also that you said that you do have to work pretty hard to make a decent living at it, I assume it's still preferable to part-time writing and part-time quote-unquote day job that a lot of artists have to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, normal, and most of the writers I know do that. That said, I don't prefer it. I'm much happier. I would rather be broken writing than have it. I did the full-time or did the part-time job and part-time writing. I've even done full-time job and part-time writing, and it was generally very difficult. And mostly I would steal time from my day job to write anyway, which is, you know, probably immoral, but hey, screw that. So I was not really a big fan of the whole, like, you know, writers tend to be, once you really, like, if you're really that kind of person, like, you like to sit, you know, in your little cave and make up stuff about unicorns and whatever. It's not always the greatest, we don't play well with normal life sometimes. So.
Do you ever find it difficult to keep your creativity level up in order to write all these books?
Yeah, it's not really, the creative part isn't actually the difficult part. It's mostly just sort of, because writing is work, and to some degree it's tedious. I mean, I don't mean to say that the actual sitting down and creating creative stuff is tedious, but it's like actually like, okay, I have to produce 3,000 words today and I have to make that happen somehow. Like that can sort of be like, oh God, I have to do this every day. But the actual creative part is great. I mean, I have a notebook full of potential story ideas and, publishers looking to theoretically publish them, and it's, you know, pretty great. At the end of the day, I could be pushing a fucking mop somewhere, so I'm not gonna be too upset about it.
When you say you have a notebook of ideas, do you have to typically approach a publisher with the idea and I guess some maybe an outline or whatever to get them interested? How does that typically
happen? Yeah, the general process is you have to actually approach them with a completed novel.
Oh boy.
And that is still mostly true for me, though. Once I publish with someone, with a publisher, they are likelier to look at outlines and ideas and give me a contract based on that. Like Blue Blazes was not a book I wrote first. I got the contract before I wrote it. I pitched it and they said, this is cool. And I didn't even have to do an outline for them. They were actually pretty, pretty groovy about it. They just said, let's go ahead with it. And that was my second contract with them. So, I hopefully will be writing more books in that universe with them. So no, they actually let me pitch it, without actually having to write it first. And that's sort of the sweet spot, because it sucks to have to write a book and get, you know, 90,000 words on paper and no one will want it.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
Then you feel stupid.
I think that would be crushing to have to shop something around and have it rejected.
Well, that's like Blackbirds, my first actual original novel was, I think, out in the marketplace for a year and a half. And I got the nicest rejections ever. And the rejections were basically like, oh, I love this book, but our sales staff thinks we can't actually sell it. It's too profane, too edgy. But we love it and we don't want to change anything. And at that point, I was sort of like a bit of a hooker about it. I'm like, I'm willing to change anything. You just tell me what you need to change and I'll do whatever. Super secret agent, whatever you need, just tell me to do it. And they're like, no, we think it's great. But I was like, well, if you think it's great, then fucking publish it. But they did not. And so it was very disheartening over the course of a year and a half to get that. And then eventually, Agri Robot, who is a smaller science fiction fantasy publisher, stepped in and they gave it a lot of support and a great cover. And since then, it's been sold in various foreign markets and, you know, it's cool.
And who are these people employed by these organizations who they're so, I don't know, just cold that they can like read through somebody through all this work and somebody put out and just be like, no, at the end?
The thing is, it sounds cold, but until you realize what these people actually have to go through, it's like, well, my agent, I mean, she gets she's not even open to submissions, and she gets, I don't know how many novels a week. And you think about the average, quote-unquote, aspiring author's novel, and it's probably not good. And they get, like, a lot of it. There's a certain degree of resentment toward publishing. Like, well, fuck those people for rejecting me. It's like, yeah, but maybe it wasn't good. I don't know. You know, it's hard to say. So they have to go through a whole ton of poop to find the pearls.
For some of these people whose stuff gets rejected, theirs wasn't the first round of shit to get fired across their bow, right?
Yeah. Right. And the other thing is they only publish so many books a year. So even if it's something they theoretically like, if they feel they can't get a return on investment on it. I mean, it's a business. At the end of the day, publishers are a business. It's nice to be like, well, it's art and it's creation and creativity. But, I mean, at the end of the day, they're trying to sell books. So, but that's the nice thing now about something like, you know, digital self-publishing is you have the ability to say, well, I don't have the audience that they want me to have, but I still have an audience that can support me. That idea of, like, if you have 1,000 true fans, you can carry yourself. So that there's now a new option. There's a new way up the mountain for authors.
Are there any prerequisites to get yourself self-published on like Amazon and stuff like that?
Have a file.
Really? That's it? It's that easy,
huh? One word in it.
Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
A file, a heartbeat, and a pulse.
There's no prerequisite. And there's some very bad stuff out there.
And how does pricing work on those? Do you set your own price?
Set your own price. With Amazon, you get the sweetest, quote-unquote, royalty, even though it's not technically royalty, between $2.99 and $9.99. If you go below that or above that, you only get 30%. If you stick in that sweet spot, it's 70%.
That makes sense because everything I see is around that, yeah.
Yeah, and Amazon wants you to sell at that point because they want to, A, make enough money themselves, but then also, B, keep the price at a sane, competitive level.
Do you put any of your stuff out on ebook? I know that you have done some self-publishing, but like your proper novels, do you put that stuff out on ebook as well?
I did put one novel out. I started with a novella called Shotgun Gravy, and it's about this sort of Veronica Mars type character, except she's on Adderall and has a shotgun. so it's, you know, really good young adult stuff. Nothing like having kids with guns.
Yeah.
So that was a novella, and I sold it for like a buck, just because it was a short novella, and it was a little edgy and strange, and it sold very well, and I was excited about that. And I decided to kickstart a sequel to it that was a novel called Bait Dog, which had like the same character, but it's like dog fighting and a murder that has to be solved. So I hit my 100% of my funding within 10 hours of the 30-day campaign, and then by the end of it, it was over 200% funded. And so I did self-publish that then and put it on Amazon, and it did okay for me financially, but what was interesting was Amazon now actually is not just Amazon who sells stuff. They're Amazon. They actually have publishers, like actual New York publishers that will put books out on shelves, even in bookstores that are not Amazon supported. And so they bought the rights to Bait Dog and then an as yet unwritten sequel and paid me for it. So they're actually going to be publishing. So I had these self-published works that became or will become published. And also I did, I take at my website and my blog, I blog a lot about writing. And so I take some of those posts and I edit them and add some stuff and I put them in these ebooks, like 500 Ways to Be a Better Writer. And it's profane and funny and stupid and whatever. But Writer's Digest then came to me and said, well, we'd like to put some of these together, and we'd like to put 1,001 of these sort of like writing tips together in a print book. So they bought the rights to do a print book. So self-publishing can actually lead to real, quote-unquote, real publishing deals.
That's really, really cool, man.
It's a weird new world, but it's cool. It's exciting.
It's really encouraging because self-publishing sounds analogous to podcasting. I mean,
yeah.
Talent seems optional, thank goodness, right? Because that's why we're here.
Ain't that the truth?
If you get enough fans, you reach critical mass, and next thing you know, we're like doing one of those zany zoo morning shows somewhere.
Right, and it's all Lamborghinis and supermodels.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I like that the supermodels are a common thread. You get artsy, the supermodels just, hey, I'm a supermodel, I'm here.
Rain upon you.
Yeah. What are you reading these days, speaking of the written word?
Reading is tricky for me, because it's like between the actual writing and having a toddler, it's like I got to really carve out time. I just read a book called The Fifth Wave by Rick Yancey, which was a lot of fun, kind of a young adult alien invasion. The great thing about young adult books is they're some of the edgiest fiction out there. Some of the most creative and edgiest work is being done in the young adult space. It's effectively R-rated most of the time. So it's cool. And then I read, there's a book by an author named Lauren Bucus. It's coming out, but I read an early copy of it called The Shining Girls. And it's about a time-traveling serial killer, and it is fucking amazing. Really, really great book. Totally, like, Stephen King, Peter Straub, sort of, but with this great sort of feminist vibe to it. Really awesome book. So excited to have read that. I think that'll do really well, do huge.
That's cool. That sounds like that's right up my alley. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, I think even a trailer that just premiered this week on Entertainment Weekly.
Nice.
Cool. So you find a little time to do some reading. And do you is the toddler of an age where you have to do some reading at bedtime?
Yeah, I read to him every night. Yeah.
Okay.
And we've been reading to him actually even since he was sub-toddler, which is I think what they call that stage, right? Just sub-toddler.
Toddling, I think it is.
Toddling,
like
yeah. Toddlets.
Yeah. Since he was a toddlet. So reading some Shining Girls to the toddler?
Yeah, exactly. He occasionally picks one of my books off the shelves. I'm like, no, don't read that. You can't read that till you're about 30.
And even then, no.
Yeah, don't do that.
Cool. I guess there's one final question we would ask. We've all got our different preferred gadgets for reading, sort of why we were questioning you about your opinion on e-readers. Now that we know you don't have a negative opinion on digital readers, we'd like to know if you have a favorite.
I have actually never read on a Kindle or a Nook, so I can't really comment on how awesome and or shitty they are. I have an iPad, and it has all the apps that I need. It has the Nook, and which is why I think I'm not an Apple like zealot. I have both Windows machines and Apple stuff. But at least in terms of e-reading, the iPad is, for me, perhaps superior. And some Android devices are the same way, but the iPad just feels really good for me. And then it can has all the apps, right? You can have the iBooks, which mostly has no books on it, but Kindle app. Kobo, which is actually getting a little bigger, which is the X sort of Borders version. You can have all that stuff, so it's like a stop, drop, and go for all of those. So I'm a big fan of the iPad.
Cool. Yeah, and the reasons you gave are definitely valid. When I was using e-reading software on my phone for the longest time, just until I decided to finally pick up a Nook, and now I kind of regret that I have all this stuff for Kindle that I can't read.
Oh, right. Yeah, and Nook is getting maybe bought by Microsoft or something. There's some.
So I've heard. Yeah. God, that means I'm gonna have some weird like tiles display on my Nook before long.
Yuck.
Run, burn it, throw it.
And
in
that
fire.
Stupid paperclip's gonna come back and.
He will.
He's gonna give me reading suggestions.
Oh God, I hate that guy.
Sounds like you like young adult fiction. Can I help you? No, leave me alone. Paperclip.
Oh, damn it. Have you read The Hunger Games? Yes. Jesus Christ, I read that. Course,
have you considered e-publishing? Whatever, leave me alone.
10 years ago,
I'm sorry, e-publishing was a dated
dated
term. I meant to say self-publishing.
No, but of course, because it's the stupid paperclip, it would be the dated thing.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right. Yeah, yeah.
And he'd be bent up into a dollar sign, and he like helps you go through the steps to make money on your EPUB.
In the next millennium, everybody's going to be e-publishing. You want to be one of the first. Okay. Seriously.
Have you considered the Gutenberg printing press?
What the hell was e-publishing other than e in front of the word publishing? Do you know?
It was self-publishing. It just means digital publishing. It means e-books.
Okay. Kind of like information superhighway meant internet.
Yeah. It's just, it's a collapsing term.
It's like email.
Yeah.
Same thing. Stuff always sounds cooler before you know what it is exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Then you're like, oh, it's not sexy. It's just a letter on my computer.
Yeah. I have an e-machine, et cetera.
Exactly.
Well, cool, man. Thanks for thanks for coming on. Any you want to replug or plug anything before we wrap it?
I'll just say go to my website. Isn't that the thing all the kids do? They have websites, quote unquote.
E-websites.
Yeah. E-publishing websites. On the Gutenberg Printing Press, I publish a website called terribleminds.com, TerribleMinds.com, and there I talk about writing and life and toddlers and profanity. And there you can also find me via Twitter, which is first name, last name, Chuck Wendig. And I talk about insane stuff there too. Ta-da.
Cool. Well, like I said, we definitely provide a wealth of stalker information. So we'll send people your way.
And you have my tacking beacon or my tagging beacon here stuck on my ear. So we're good.
Great. Wonderful. Yeah. We'll facilitate e-stalking.
Kick ass. Great. I'm happy to accept any and all stalkers.
Great. We're so glad. Well, with that said, we will we'll conclude our interview. Thanks a lot for being on. We really enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, that concludes tonight's episode. Special thanks again to Chuck Wendig for appearing. And I'd like to remind our e-listeners that they can go on over to the e-iTunes. And once there, use their e-keyboards to type in a favorable review. You should probably outline it and then flesh it out per Chuck's advice. As well, you should rate us a maximum number of stars. And feel free to subscribe. We would appreciate that.
And if you don't like the e-iTunes, you can head on over to http://www.nerdstravaganza.com, where you can download the show, rate the show, stream the show, all kinds of good stuff.
Or you can stalk us on Facebook, www.facebook.com/nerdstravaganza. And if you really like what you see, be sure to join the group.
El Grupo!
El Grupo Especial.
No, I appreciate it. This was fun. Sometimes they're not fun. This was fun.
Look for my upcoming self-published guide to life, Tom's Inane Thoughts.
I hope it's erotica.
It's self-erotica.
Yeah, nice. Awesome.
If you ever wondered what I look like, you'll know every inch of me. As I explore.
Describe a blind person caressing an elephant.
Oh, God. Exactly. I explore with the written word parts of me you didn't know human beings had.
It's beautiful.
Gross. It's really not.